In this hour at Focus 580, we will talk about how we are changing the way that we think about diseases, diseases like cancer, heart disease, others, for example. It has been our habit now to think about these primarily as the result of genetics and also of lifestyle. However, there are a number of researchers that are starting to look at a different sort of analysis of these kinds of diseases and have suggested that, in fact, many of them may be the result of infections, that they are viral in their origin. We'll be talking this morning with Paul Ewalt. He is a biologist. He's professor of biology at Amherst College. He has been featured in a number of publications, including The Atlantic and Newsweek and Discover. He is the author of a new book that explores this territory. The title of his book is Plague Time: How Stealth Infections Cause Cancers, Heart Disease, and Other Deadly Ailments. It is published by the Free Press and is out now. It came out in the fall, so you should be able to find it in bookstore if you'd like to read it. And also, we are here and open to your questions if you'd like to talk with him. All we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief in their questions so we can keep things moving along. But anyone's welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Ewalt, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
I'm happy to.
We appreciate it. I guess to begin, maybe we could talk about the term, we define the term virulence, because it's something that you deal with right at the beginning of the book. And in this way, because when we think about infectious diseases, I'm sure that most people think of them as you suggest in the book. And I think you write about it very nicely. You write, typically, acute infectious diseases turn quick profits for short-term gain. The pathogens that cause them are corporate raiders out to get rich quick rather than maintain the health of their targets. And that's kind of the way we think about infectious disease. It's something that comes on suddenly within a relatively short period after the time that you get the bug. Generally speaking, if we're lucky, our immune systems eventually kick in, as with a cold, for example, and take care of it. But here now we're looking at a rather different sort of a model of how infectious disease would work.
Right. Well, getting back to your first question, virulence really just refers to how harmful the disease is. So a virulence of an infectious disease would be, you know, measured by how likely it is to cause a person to be incapacitated or how likely it is to maybe cause a person to die. And so when we're talking about infectious agents, the virulence of an infectious agent would be the inherent harmfulness of that particular agent. But your more general question is, I think, addressing the heart of the matter, and that is that it was easy for us to recognize these acute infectious diseases, things like chickenpox and smallpox. And in fact, these diseases were recognized as caused by infection 100 years before the organisms were identified, even before the first part of the germ theory revolution occurred in the latter part of the 19th century. So as far back as the 1840s, 1830s, people realized that chickenpox and smallpox were caused by infection. They didn't really understand that clearly what infection was, but it was something growing inside of people that could be transmitted from one person to another, and people recognized it because people could see it in their daily lives. Your child gets chickenpox, and then the playmate of your child gets chickenpox 10 days later, and the playmate of that playmate gets chickenpox 10 days later. So you didn't have to be brilliant deductively to realize that something was growing inside of people and being transmitted. But from the early 1800s all the way to the year 2001, there's been this steady process in which we've, every decade, recognized more and more diseases are caused by infection. And at any decade, people have sort of thought, well, now we understand infectious diseases. And so in the late 19th century, or late 19th century, people were arguing about whether the sexually transmitted diseases were caused by infection, whether diarrheal diseases were caused by infection. Now, at the beginning of the 21st century, we're arguing about diseases that, if they are caused by infection, they're caused in so much a more cryptic way that it's very hard to get the evidence to conclusively demonstrate it. In fact, what we've learned in the last 20 years is that we can't use the old standards of evidence to agree on whether a disease is caused by infection, because the old standards were based on different kinds of diseases. The old standards, like Koch's postulates, for example, which argues that you have to take the organism, purify it, and infect a model, or you know, perhaps a human if you've got an ethical way of doing that, let's say if the suspected pathogen was extremely mild, and then generate the disease and then isolate the organism again from the diseased individuals. This was one of the old standards, and it just doesn't work for the diseases that we're now recognizing as being caused by infection, those that we've recognized in the last two decades as being caused by infection. So it's never really been satisfied. Koch's postulates, for example, have never been satisfied rigorously for the diseases like cervical cancer, which everybody agrees is caused by infection now, or for liver cancer, much of which is caused by infection, or stomach cancers, or peptic ulcers, for that matter. So finally, after we've recognized, sort of grudgingly, I think, that we have to keep changing our guidelines for accepting infectious causation as we solve the easy problems of infectious causation, and we move towards the more complicated examples, the more cryptic examples of infectious causation. When we realize that we have to do that, we always have to be on the move, then we begin to make more progress in identifying that a lot of these chronic diseases are caused by infection. Now, the difference between acute diseases and chronic diseases with regard to infectious diseases is really one of time. The acute infectious diseases, as you mentioned, come on strong, and typically the immune system knocks them out within a matter of a few weeks, and then the battle is over. But for chronic diseases, you have disease organisms coming in, and for one reason or another, they have abilities to persist inside of the body. And so you may not even see any obvious signs of infection early on. There may be almost no symptoms of infection early on, but over a period of years, decades, sometimes as much as a half century, the negative effects may arise, sometimes arising very gradually or sometimes arising quite suddenly. And now that we've sort of moved into this phase, it's becoming clear that we have to be continually changing the way in which we decide to agree or not agree on whether a disease is caused by infection. Just to give you a quick example, one of the chronic diseases that has been accepted as caused by infection in the last two decades is a leukemia called adult T-cell leukemia. And people who are developing the leukemia are typically infected when they're born from mother's milk, and then they develop the leukemia anywhere from 40 to 80 years later. So how do you actually satisfy something like the Koch's postulates if you've got a disease with a 60-year lag time? I mean, how are you going to get a mouse that lives for 60 years? And in fact, in this case, you can't even duplicate the disease in any animal model. So what we had to do in the last 20 years is to look very carefully and really, I think, much more thoughtfully at patterns, epidemiological patterns. Where is the disease present? Is the disease so firmly linked to particular disease organisms that no other explanation makes any sense? And if no one can think of any other reasonable explanation, then medicine says, okay, this disease now we accept as being caused by infection. So there have been about 15 or so diseases in the last 20 years, chronic diseases that have been accepted as being caused by infection, things like the cancers I mentioned, and now we've got another 15 or so of the major diseases, chronic diseases that are killing us now in America and all throughout the world, that are strongly suspected as being caused by infection. In fact, the evidence is so strong that if you were to just bring people into the discipline, show them the evidence for all of the various explanations, people would say, well, of course infection is probably going to be at the heart of the pathological process. Now, it's important to realize that saying that infection is a primary cause or a major cause of these chronic diseases, I'm talking about diseases like atherosclerosis and heart attacks and stroke and Alzheimer's disease, the major mental illnesses like schizophrenia and autism and bipolar disorder, cancers, most of the cancers probably, at least 15 to 20% of the cancers are now accepted as being caused by infectious agents, and I think it'll probably end up being more like 80 or 90% will turn out to have infections playing a primary role. So now as we look at these chronic diseases that are really major sources of morbidity and mortality in populations like the American population, and if we find that infection is playing a major role, we have to be very clear that just because infection is playing a role doesn't mean that genetics and lifestyles are not playing a role. In fact, for every infectious disease that we understand well, there are host genetic, that is human genetic, predispositions, and there are also lifestyles or environmental, non-infectious environmental influences. And so this is a very important thing to consider because what's happened in the last 50 years is people have gotten so focused on genetic causation and environmental causation of disease, lifestyle influences on disease, that they, when they've found some associations, they've then made the very important mistake of assuming that the positive support for environmental influences on disease or genetic influences on disease excludes the possible role of infectious causation. And that's been a terrible mistake. You can see why that would be a terrible mistake just by looking at the diseases that everybody recognizes are caused by infection. So, for example, for tuberculosis, we know there are genetic predispositions for tuberculosis, but we call it an infectious disease because we know that if you eliminate the organism, you don't get the disease. So I think that's what we're going to find for these other diseases as well, that when we eliminate the organisms, we essentially don't get the disease.
Let me, at this point, probably introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're speaking with Paul Ewald. He's professor of biology at Amherst College. If you're interested in reading some more on this subject, look for his book, Plague Time, How Stealth Infections Cause Cancers, Heart Disease, and Other Deadly Ailments. Came out in the fall, published by the Free Press. Been getting a lot of attention in media. And your questions here on the show are also welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. To the extent that people think at all about how infectious diseases operate, I'm sure, as we talked a little bit about at the beginning, their idea is, well, you have this bug, it gets into the person, and it uses the person as a host to very quickly reproduce itself, sometimes at the expense of the host, just burning up the person. And that very quickly, it does this very quickly, and then it very quickly jumps from one person to the next person and repeats that over again and then jumps to the next person. If you, though, think about it from the, I'm interested that in the book you think about things from the germ's perspective. Mm-hmm. If you think about it from the germ's perspective, what's in it? What sort of advantage might be posed or might come with operating in this stealth mode where you have the infection that's there, it may be there for long periods of time with maybe no symptoms or symptoms so subtle that it could, that years or maybe even decades could go by before the person came to realize that something was wrong, something was going on?
Well, to a large extent, this depends on how the disease organism gets transmitted. Mm-hmm. So typically, when you look at the respiratory tract infections, they tend to be the garden variety acute infectious diseases. They're causing a flood of production of viruses or bacteria, and then people are sneezing or coughing, and then transmitting these bacteria or viruses to other individuals as a result of moving around and coming close contact with susceptibles. But for some kinds of transmission, the premium must be on persistence inside of a host. And the two kinds of transmission that probably fit this idea the best are transmission by what we can think of as hardcore sex or softcore sex. Hardcore sex would be, you know, what we think of as normally sexually transmitted diseases, genital contact. Softcore sex would be things like kissing. But in either case, because people aren't going around having as much sex with other people or kissing other people as much as they are going around sneezing and coughing on other people, there has to be a premium, from the pathogen's point of view, there has to be a premium on long-term survival inside of the host. Okay, so what does that mean? It means that the pathogen has to have tricks up its sleeve for avoiding the immune system. If it doesn't have those tricks up the sleeve, it's just out of the game right away, because it's got to last for sometimes months or even years in order to get transmitted. Okay, so now the question is, if it's got tricks up its sleeve, what will happen over the long run? If it can avoid the immune system, then essentially what you've got is something like a wrench in machinery. If the wrench doesn't end up messing up the machinery in the short run, it may mess it up in the long run. And so what you typically have are diseases that are associated with this messing up of the machinery. And it gets compounded because some of the ways in which these disease organisms avoid the immune system involve living inside of the cells and sort of taking over the cells and pushing them a little bit closer towards a disease state that can be life-threatening for us. So for an example, we talked a little bit about the human we talked about cervical cancer, which is caused by the human papillomavirus. And the human papillomavirus can avoid the immune system by getting into cells and integrating into those cells' DNA and then causing the cells to divide. And it can also, as a result of the proteins that it codes for, it can make the cell unable to destroy itself. And it can also activate the cells. It can also make it so that the cells cannot shut down their reproduction in response to detection of something wrong in the cells, like genetic damage. So what this means is that the papillomavirus can have sort of a free ride, or relatively free ride. It can get its cells it's living in to divide. It can divide right along with it. And because it's inside those cells, not really very much exposed to the immune system, it can be replicating itself without risking very much in the way of destruction. So the problem for us is that by short-circuiting those measures that the cell has for controlling its own replication, the virus has pushed those cells towards cancer. Now if you have just one or two mutations, in addition to those changes that the virus has introduced, you may get full-blown metastatic cancer, which then can be life-threatening. So the idea is that there's a conflict of interest between these pathogens. The pathogens, in this case, papillomavirus, which is sexually transmitted, has to live inside of a host for a long period of time, has to avoid the immune system. It's devised or evolved fairly clever ways of manipulating the cell so that it can replicate without getting destroyed by the immune system, and that's just pushed the system closer to cancer. And what happens is in a small proportion of the people who are infected with the cancer-causing serotypes of the human papillomavirus, you actually get the cancer. And if those women haven't had their pap smears, they don't get that beginning stage of cancer detected, and they don't have appropriate interventions, then they may run a risk of dying.
We have a couple of callers here. Let's bring them into the conversation, starting with Belgium, line number 4. Hello?
Yes. I think I've discussed this in the past with you, Mr. Inge, and a couple other guests, mentioning that it may seem very dark, but aren't viruses just another way of controlling the population or diseases, just the population of human beings on the earth? I mean, we have no other natural enemies. You know, everything has its own way of being eaten or eating. Isn't this just something we're never going to be able to get rid of? It is a controlling factor for our populations.
Oh, well, we've got much better ways of controlling our own population than by relying on viruses.
Well,
one way that's probably the most effective of all is improving standards of living, and then giving people the option of birth control. That has so effectively controlled population size in places like the United States and Europe that population is actually declining in these areas. So I mean, there are other ways one could imagine of controlling population size, like genocide, but there are certain ways that are not acceptable to us, and then there are some that are very much acceptable. And I think the idea that we allow people to have options that then allow them to choose not to have kids.
No, sir, I think you're missing the point I'm trying to make. The point I'm trying to make is the natural world itself is going to find a way to control things.
This is a very important point, and this is a misunderstanding that people have about ecology in general. And in fact, this is where my training was in ecology and evolution to begin with, so I'm pretty familiar with this. The important point is that there will be, and this first part is consistent with what you're saying, is that the population sizes can't grow indefinitely. Something's going to limit them. It's either going to be food, or it's going to be predators, it's going to be parasites.
Sure.
Okay, but now having said that, then I think we move from the way things are to the way we can control things in our society. And basically, we make decisions so that we will cause, you know, basically we have options. Some options are going to be much more painful for people. Some are not. Or more generally, some options are going to be consistent with the values that we hold dearest, and some aren't. And so in this case, the point I'd like to make is that the decisions that we have do offer many very favorable opportunities, and some of those favorable opportunities involve knocking out pathogens that are particularly destructive. There's no reason why we should feel that we have to live with certain kinds of pathogens. We've been very successful at knocking out some of the worst ones, and once we understand that diseases are caused by pathogens, then we can continue to do so. And then just the last point I want to make is that sometimes people feel that if you knock out one pathogen, another pathogen will come in and take its place, and there's really no basis for believing that. The evidence so far indicates that if you knock out a pathogen, it isn't going to be that another pathogen will come in and take its place. The more appropriate way of looking at this is that if you have pathogens that are causing problems, you can nudge the system so that you favor some competing pathogens with others. They'll typically be pathogens that we link together in the same species. And so there are many very powerful ways of doing this. For example, ways of making vaccines so that you favor the mild strains over the harmful strains. But I think it's very important not to just jump to this conclusion that pathogens have been here for a long period of time, and so it's inevitable, and they're a natural part. And so therefore, this is the final step of the logic that I would disagree with. Therefore, because they're natural, that we have to somehow put up with them.
Your last point got to the point I was referring
to.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Well, it seems that as I hear the caller, he seems, in a sense, to be posing, or perhaps I'm putting words into his mouth, posing the question, why is there disease?
I think he might have been. My sense was, and his last comment, I think, made me confident that this was the right interpretation of his sense. But my sense was that he was thinking about it as being natural, and so is there really anything we can do about it? But did you want to?
But there, I guess what I'm thinking of the question is there, if one approaches this from the point of view perhaps of the evolutionary biologist, does disease perform a function, or then are we imputing to it some intentionality that it doesn't have, and in fact all viruses are doing is just like every other life form, they're just, you know, trying to make a living?
That's the last part is the right answer.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if that's not the right answer, then we've misunderstood almost all of what has now become the basis of evolutionary biology and ecology for the last 20 or 30 years. In fact, we'd have to generate something astonishing and completely different from what we now have as a basis for these disciplines. Yeah, basically it's that when you have these different organisms, whether they're viruses or bacteria or humans, you've got the competitors within each of those species of organisms competing with each other to to make use of resources in the environment and to grow better than their competitors would, reproduce and survive better than their competitors would. And that's what creates the world as we see it. And now we have to look at that world and we say there are certain things about that world we don't like. We don't like dying of cancer, for example, or we don't like dying of acute infectious diseases. And so how can we interfere with that nature in order to make it so that we don't have the negative things that we don't like, and we're left with the things that we do like.
Let's go again to another caller. This is Urbana, line one. Hello?
Yeah, I would like to ask Mr. Ewald, if the origin of the disease is basically infectious, is it then, in principle, always possible to develop a vaccine against it?
Not always, but the track record for dealing with infectious diseases has really been remarkably good. And this is a bit of an irony when you look at where the attention has been spent in the last 50 years. There's been so much attention directed towards, let's say, identifying genetic causes of disease, and particularly focusing on the idea that maybe there's some bad genes around. Even if we found those bad genes, the question is, what would we do about it? We don't have a very good track record of dealing with genetic diseases. In contrast, when we look at the history of dealing with diseases, once we know that are infectious, once we know that they're caused by infection, then there are all sorts of things we can do. It doesn't mean that every time we'll be able to get something that's effective, but more often than not, we can generate a combination of hygienic improvements to reduce transmission, vaccines to stimulate the immune system so people won't get infected, and or antivirals, or especially antibiotics, that can help people once they are infected. And so I think this is incredibly encouraging that these chronic diseases now are turning out to be caused largely by infection. But in addition to this more rosy outlook that one can generate by looking at the possibility that these diseases are really caused by infection, there are also theoretical arguments, and then there's the data itself that indicates that this is the right answer, that, for example, genetic bad genes just aren't going to be the major part of the explanation for these.
But that isn't my question. My question is, if the disease is infectious, is it possible, always in principle, to develop a vaccine against the disease?
Well, I don't know. I thought I'd try to answer that by saying that our track record has been very good. Now, when you say, is it always possible in principle to generate a vaccine? Yeah, in principle, yes, one could always develop a vaccine.
Would that then be a substitute proof instead of this Cook's postulate?
Yes, that's a good point, because if you were to, if you had a candidate pathogen, and you weren't really sure that that pathogen was causing the disease, then you could generate a vaccine. And if you vaccinated everybody with that vaccine and you eliminated the chronic disease, then you would have satisfied
That's right.
critics. The only problem with that is that you're not going to get approval to use the vaccine unless people are already agreed that the pathogen that you're trying to control is the cause of the disease that you're trying to vaccinate against. And so you have only a limited number of possible diseases for which that kind of approach would provide the critical proof. So, for example, if you were to make a vaccine against some acute infectious disease that was known to be caused by an agent that was also suspected of causing a chronic disease, and you eliminated the chronic disease by using the vaccine to control the acute infectious disease, then that would provide that kind of proof. But many of these chronic diseases probably don't have much, if any, of an acute phase. That's what makes them so cryptic, and that's why we're arguing about them right now, is that unlike the chronic diseases that we've accepted, many of the chronic diseases we've accepted as being caused by infection, which had very clear-cut acute phases, you know, tuberculosis or syphilis, for example.
For a successful vaccine to be developed, is it necessary that the disease has an acute phase?
Well, I'm saying that you could, if you have a suspect pathogen, you could make a vaccine against that suspect pathogen, but I doubt that you're going to get approval for using that vaccine to control a chronic disease that doesn't have an acute phase, because there are always risks associated with the vaccine.
well, wasn't the first vaccine developed without having a specific germ, you know, isolated?
I'm sorry, say it again?
Wasn't the first vaccine, like the cowpox?
Oh, yes.
Wasn't that developed without...
Yes, but that's sort of a different situation. The first smallpox vaccine was generated by Jenner over 200 years ago because he noticed that people who had these cowpox lesions didn't get smallpox, and so he figured there must be something in those cowpox lesions that was protecting.
So can't you play that game now?
Yes, but see, that's not... It's not quite the same as a... a couple of things are different now. One thing is there's a lot more regulation now than there was back then. But also remember then, at that point, Jenner was dealing with an acute infectious disease that could be that couldn't be controlled in any other way. It was pretty clear that it was caused by infection at that point, and so he could do things that people wouldn't be able to do today. But even so, you know, he sent his paper describing his experiments to the Royal Society of London, and the head of the Royal Society of London flatly rejected the paper and condemned him, basically, for saying things that were so at odds with what was...
Yeah, but now you're talking prejudice and bigotry and all that kind of stuff, you know.
But you also have to... The problem is that today, the use of vaccines in a preliminary way, sort of in the pilot studies, is very much dependent on sort of the mainstream thinking. And so if Jenner, for example, had those constraints, he wouldn't have been able to do what he did. He would have been ostracized for it. And so today, I think there are these restrictions on what kinds of vaccines will be allowed to go through clinical trials. And I think if you had a vaccine that was based on a possible association between a pathogen and a chronic disease, I don't think people would allow the people who allow these preliminary trials to go ahead. I don't think they would allow that kind of trial to proceed without any strong evidence. So I'm afraid we've got more restrictions today that's going to slow progress, and it's slowing progress for a good reason. The idea is that we're trying to protect the health of subjects in experimentation. So it just makes things a little bit harder. Also, the other problem with this is that the experiments that Jenner did, so you know, Jenner actually introduced smallpox into the boy that he supposedly had protected, and actually had protected, by introducing the material from the cowpox lesions, and people wouldn't allow that to be done either. The other problem is that when you're dealing with chronic diseases, the use of a vaccine isn't as feasible because you have to wait. The vaccine as a way of determining whether the pathogen is the agent responsible for the chronic disease, it's not as acceptable because you may have to wait for 30 or 40 years before the experiment's finished, right? With smallpox, you might only have to wait for, a year. Or if you're only using a few subjects, we generally only had to wait for a few weeks.
We are entering into our last 15 minutes here, and we have some other callers, and we'll try to get in as many people as we can. I introduce again our guest. We're talking with Paul Ewalt. He's professor of biology at Amherst College. You'd like to read more on the subject, look for his book, Plague Time. It's published by the Free Press. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Urbana, I believe, on line number 4. Hello.
Oh, thanks.
Yes.
I guess I have two questions. One is probably short. I was wondering when you talk about viruses, it always seems to me I never really understood, not being a student of biology, why they weren't considered more akin to poisons that had some sort of poisonous effect on a cell's replication processes than living things. And I was just wondering if there was a short answer as to why.
Oh, yeah, the short answer is that the viruses are self-replicating, and they have the instructions for their own self-replication built in. So that's the key thing that distinguishes things like poisons from living things. So a long time people thought that viruses weren't alive, but that was, I think, largely I mean, it's a semantic issue, but I think that it makes more sense to think of them as living organisms that are just so trimmed down that basically they're little packages of genetic material and protein that are designed to land on and infect and live within, take over our cells.
So they have a little bit of DNA or RNA in them.
They have DNA. All viruses have some DNA or RNA that encodes their own genetic information.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, my real question is, when you started out talking about that leukemia, which had such a long latency period, uh-huh. I was just wondering, is it possible to give a quick idea of given that they couldn't use Koch's postulates, just how they came about, how they came around to thinking that it, you know, or proving to their own, to their cells, to the community that
interesting.
Was the case.
This was about 2 decades ago that it was finally accepted, and basically what was done is they noticed that there was a tendency for the leukemia to be occurring in very isolated areas. A lot of this work was done in Japan, and they found, so that they were looking for a virus that had a geographic distribution that matched this funny geographic distribution of the adult T-cell leukemia. And so they found that this virus, this retrovirus, it's like a distant cousin of HIV. It's called HTLV-1. They found that this retrovirus matched that geographic distribution. And then they found that every person who had the adult T-cell leukemia had the virus. Okay, so those bits of information pieced together made people say, yeah, there's no other explanation that makes any sense other than it's this virus that's causing, eventually, sometimes over a time course of 6 or 7 decades, the adult T-cell leukemia.
Well, thanks for showing just how difficult this whole area is.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to line 2. This is Bloomington. Hello. Caller there, line 2, Bloomington.
I was told I was on line 3.
Well, my apologies. You're okay, on right now.
Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. How do your ideas apply to prostate cancer?
Well, prostate cancer is a mystery. There have been some studies that indicate that prostate cancer may also have an infectious origin. There's geographic variation that looks like the kind of variation in prostate cancer you'd expect from infectious causation. There have been some foreign proteins identified from prostate cancer tissue that are similar to the foreign proteins that one finds in ovarian cancer tissue and other gynecological cancer tissue, as well as in breast cancer tissue. And so this lends some support for the idea that prostate cancer, like some of these other cancers, is caused by some pathogen, and it's just not at all clear where that pathogen may be coming from. I think that people haven't been looking at this possibility very closely, certainly not as closely as is warranted, and I think maybe as people start looking more closely at the possibility, the story will begin to make more sense, and hopefully the right experiments will be done to find out whether there really are these foreign genetic elements inside the prostate cancer tissue, and if they're there, where are they coming from? Generally, when you find these things, they're a result of viral infections. You were picking up little snippets of viruses that are in the cells.
Well, I had prostate cancer about 6 years ago, so that was interesting to me. Try to figure out how that your ideas would apply to that. Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
All right, let's go to Champaign. This is line 3. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I think we would all agree that it's always better to better understand these things than to not. But I'm not sure that I entirely share your optimism about how this will improve our condition. As an example, HIV, it was understood, once it was recognized that it existed, it was understood fairly early on how to prevent its spread. But most of the effort was spent in trying to develop a vaccine and trying to develop treatments rather than trying to educate people and to make condoms and sterile needles available everywhere. And in the different countries of the world that have used these two different approaches. The ones that have tried to use the obvious ways of preventing spread have been, in general, quite successful. And the ones that have gone the other route are, except for the very rich countries, are sort of in the tank. And it seems to me that
I agree with you much more than you think.
Okay.
My point is that when we find out that a pathogen is causing a disease, we don't know whether we're going to luck out and we're going to be able to control that pathogen or not. Some pathogens, like HIV, are going to be really tricky. And I've been writing and following the HIV experience really almost from the beginning of the research that implicated virus as a cause of AIDS. And one of the points I've been making is that this is a really tricky virus. We're not likely to control this virus in the long run by a vaccine because of the characteristics of the virus. This is one that one for which we haven't lucked out on, and we're not going to luck out on. I think it's worth doing research on vaccine development. I think it's worth definitely doing research on antiviral drugs. But the one thing for control of AIDS that we know should work is getting the information out there about how dangerous unprotected sex is and how dangerous it is to have more partners rather than fewer partners, and then getting the information out there about the value of using condoms. And by getting this information out, I think we know we could have some controlling effect. It's not going to stop the virus in its tracks, but it certainly is going to be something that's going to have a positive effect. Because the virus is so mutation prone, the hope that we're going to get a vaccine that's going to last for more than a few years is pretty slim. I think we will get some vaccines against HIV, but they're just not going to be having the same kind of effectiveness that the vaccines, for example, against measles has had, or the vaccine against smallpox had.
Yeah. My point is a much more general one.
Mm-hmm.
With respect to motor vehicle accidents,
mm-hmm.
it's something that has become familiar and accepted that when an automobile is provided, when the manufacturer is provided an automobile that corners better or brakes better or so forth, that there's an adjustment that goes on where people drive faster and take more chances, so that they're moving back toward a sort of set point.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we see this in health matters, where it's known that even now, hospital personnel don't wash their hands
yes.
often enough.
Yeah.
And the antibiotics that that figure so strongly in your case,
mm-hmm.
we're in process of losing control.
Yes.
So that we may be back to where we were in the 20s.
Yeah. But, a couple things. One thing is sort of going from the last point to your earlier points. I don't put too much reliance on antibiotics because I think they're not a very good way of controlling the spread of infectious diseases. They're good for treating people who have disease that you can control with that antibiotic, but as soon as you start trying to use them to control the organism in a population, you generate the antibiotic resistance problem. Now, with regard to the idea that as soon as you start solving the problem, people start getting lax, that is a big problem. But I think the solution is not to try to solve the problem by using, let's say, a vaccine that will knock out the pathogens. I think the solution is to go ahead and generate the vaccine if you think it's going to work, but then also don't let up on the other control measures, because we have these three control measures. We've got hygienic improvements, we've got antimicrobials, and then we've got vaccines that have been the mainstay of medicine for the last two centuries to the last 50 years, depending on which combination of those things we're talking about. I think it's important not to let advancements in one of those take away from the effectiveness in others, not to get lax on one of those just because we've got something else that could allow a person to become lax. And I think that has happened in hospital environments because antibiotics seem to be this magic bullet. People started relying on antibiotics instead of keeping the hygienic measures at a high standard. And as a consequence, I think we've seen a lot of problems in hospitals. And now those problems are becoming amplified because of the antibiotic resistance that's been generated. Now people can't rely on the antibiotics in the same way that they were relied on 40 years ago. And people have gotten out of the habit of maintaining high hygienic standards. And so I think that the solution is to make sure that people follow all of those three, the appropriate guidelines for all of those three control measures that I mentioned before, not to, let's say, let up on the hygienic control measure just because you've got something like an antibiotic that you can use as a solution for a particular patient.
We have just about 2 minutes, and I want to try to get one more caller in here in Urbana on line one. I'll have to ask you to be quick, though.
Can you explain the difference between... Can you explain what prions are? I understand they're infectious proteins, but they're not viruses.
Yeah, prions are a big mystery because everybody had thought that all disease organisms, all organisms had to have DNA or RNA, and here you had this thing that was clearly causing terrible degenerative diseases that would kill people, making their brains into Swiss cheese, essentially, and it didn't seem to have any RNA or DNA in it. So it looks like what the right answer is that these are proteins that are essentially have the same building blocks and the same sequence as proteins in our bodies, but they have a slightly different way of bending on each other. Okay, so that although the protein has the same sequence, it has a different shape, and this the prions that are associated with these diseases like Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease or Kuru or mad cow disease. They, when they get inside of a body, they tend to change the conformation of our version of the protein into that prion version of the protein. And then when they do that, these prion conformations tend to group together, and it's believed that that grouping together, it's almost like a crystallization process, is what eventually causes the destruction, in this case, of neuronal tissue, and then the downfall of the patient.
We're going to have to stop here, I'm sorry to say, because we're just at the end of the time. To anyone who is interested in the subject, again, I suggest you look at the book that we've been talking about. The title of the book is Plague Time. It's published by the Free Press, and the author, our guest, Paul Ewald, he's professor of biology at Amherst College. Professor Ewald, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.